This is Jim Inkster, and welcome to Talk Louisiana, originating from the Investar Tower in Baton Rouge. Your number is 877-217-5757. Renee Martin and Robin Dow are producing, and our guest is Craig Unger. He's been with us before, but it's been a few years, and he's back with a new slant. A big part of his journalistic career has involved covering this story, which is now a book. It's called Den of Spies, Reagan Carter, and the Secret History of the Treason that Stole the White House. It was a tinderbox of an accusation. In April of 1991, the New York Times ran an op-ed challenging Ronald Reagan's 1980 presidential campaign, saying it conspired with the Iranian government to delay the release of 52 American hostages until after the 1980 election. The Iranian hostage crisis was President Carter's biggest political vulnerability. His failure to free the hostages ultimately doomed him at the ballot box. In return for keeping Americans in captivity until President Reagan assumed the oath of office, the Republicans, according to Craig Unger, had secretly funded arms to Iran. Treasonous and illegal, the operation planned and executed by Reagan's campaign manager Bill Casey amounted to a shadow foreign policy run by private citizens that ensured Reagan's victory. And Reagan did win. He carried 44 states. It was a landslide against an incumbent president, and Ronald Reagan was elected 4 years later carrying 49 states. So he left office as one of the most successful presidents at the ballot box of all time. But Craig Unger was one of the first reporters who covered the October surprise, initially for Esquire, then for Newsweek. And while attempting to unravel this mystery, he was sued for his reporting and discredited by members of his own Washington press corps as a counterintuitive narrative took hold. And now this story is back in a way that has been supported by information not unearthed before. And good morning to you, Craig Unger.
Good morning to you. It's great to be here.
Your thoughts about why it took so long? This has been 44 years.
Right. And I should say, yesterday just happened to be President Carter's 100th birthday. And I think it's long past time he was treated with the kind of respect that he deserves by history. He went out of his presidency and was sort of seen as a failed president who allowed the hostages to languish. And in fact, what my book shows is that he was sabotaged by Republicans who hijacked his foreign policy and made a secret and treasonous deal with the Islamic fundamentalist regime in Iran.
Did President Reagan then... candidate Reagan, did he know anything about this?
Well, you know, there's a very funny quote. It's a story. Whenever Reagan was talked about this, this is what he said. His campaign manager, Bill Casey, was, I think, the greatest spy in American history. And it was Casey who was the spy master, who orchestrated this covert operation. And Reagan would say, Casey was known for mumbling. His nickname was Mumbles, in effect. And he talked as if his mouth was full of marbles. And Reagan would say, you know, I can't understand a word Bill Casey says. And you can ask him to repeat himself once. You can ask him to repeat himself twice. But if you ask a third time, that's rude. So I just nod my head and smile. And you get an image that Reagan may have known the broad strokes of what was going on, but he really didn't know the details. So I don't think it's entirely clear exactly what Reagan knew. But Casey, on the other hand, really was a master spy. This was an extraordinary covert operation. Just imagine, with one hand, Casey was running a winning presidential campaign, and he was in the media spotlight 24/7. This is the summer of 1980. And then secretly, with the other hand, he was orchestrating a covert operation that meant he needed to know illegal arms dealers all over the world. He had secret communications with Israeli intelligence and his own team of operatives who would be setting up secret meetings for him all over the world in Madrid and Paris and so forth with the Iranians.
877-217-5757 is your number. Craig Unger is the guest. His book is Denim Spies, Reagan Carter, The Secret History of What He Calls the Treason That Stole the White House. Treason's a strong word, but you say it's the accurate word. Why?
Absolutely. I mean, the only people in charge of foreign policy in the United States are our duly elected representatives. And at that time, Bill Casey and the Republican campaign, the Reagan campaign, were not in the government. What they did was to hijack American foreign policy and make a secret deal with a hostile foreign power. I mean, remember at the time, the Republicans used to make jokes about bombing Iran back to the Stone Age, and the Iranians were marching in the street chanting death to America and calling us the Great Satan. But at the same time, Bill Casey and the Reagan campaign were secretly sending weapons to them. And in return for sending weapons to Iran, they had a favor. They wanted Iran not to release the hostages, but to prolong their detention until after the election. Otherwise, Carter would get credit for bringing them home, and there'd be a wave of patriotic fervor that might help him in the election.
But it was a landslide. Would it have made any difference?
Well, it might well have. I mean, it's always impossible to say definitively about these things. But if you go back just a few days earlier, the polls were very, very close, and Carter was even ahead for some time in October, and the entire country was poised. All the country could think about was getting home the hostages. I think a lot of your listeners are too young to remember this or weren't even born. But every night, Walter Cronkite on the news would say, hostages have been incarcerated. In the end, it was a total of 444 days. So there was an ongoing countdown. There, people were tying yellow ribbons around trees in hope of the hostages. This was a powerful emotional issue that tugged at the heartstrings of America. And Carter was painted as a failed president who was too weak to bring them home.
Well, you note that the victory by Reagan ushered in a new era of conservatism. Of course, that era has now been altered with the ascension of Donald Trump. But the election was one of those watershed elections of 1980. How would history have been changed if Carter had won re-election?
Wow. Well, you know, if you just look, Reagan was not only elected, he was re-elected, and then George H.W. Bush Sr. was then elected. So you have three presidential terms there right in a row before Clinton. I'd have to go back and count the number of Supreme Court justices they appointed, but this is one way the Republicans ended up with the supermajority in the United States Supreme Court. I think in many ways what this is, it's a precursor of what we see in the age of Donald Trump. That is, this is a really, as I say, treasonous interference, sabotage with an American presidential election. And, I count in the book the number of times this has happened with the Republicans. It happened in 1968 before the Reagan. This is during the Nixon-Hubert Humphrey election. And it was towards the end. Lyndon Johnson was trying to end the Vietnam War. There were peace talks in Paris. And Nixon intervened, and he got a third party, a woman named Anna Chennault, to go to communicate with the South Vietnamese and get them to withdraw from the peace talks at the last minute. So the Vietnam War was prolonged for many, many years, and another, I think, 30 or 40,000 Americans died as a result of that. And Nixon won the election because it looked like the Democrats were incompetent. So that it happened in 68. Nixon was concerned that all those conversations had been secretly taped by the Democrats, and he got some burglars to try to steal those documents and tapes, and they broke into the Brookings Institute and a hotel office complex known as the Watergate. So there you have again interference in the election. 68, 72, as I report in this book, 1980. It's happening again and again and again.
And all of those were victorious elections for the candidates you're speaking of. But a listener notes that I have the book and I've read a good portion of it, but I don't know if this is in here, about the supposed debate prep book that was stolen from Carter. Did that really happen?
Absolutely. I mean, there were congressional investigations. I have all the documents. And actually, even James Baker, who was, a very close friend of then vice presidential candidate George H.W. Bush.
Okay, hold that thought. We'll pick up with that and have a few more minutes with Craig Unger after this. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. 877-217-5757. A few more minutes from Craig Unger. The book is Den of Spies, and it's about the 1980 presidential election between Jimmy Carter and Ronald Reagan. Carter turned 100 yesterday, but he was 13 years younger than Ronald Reagan, 13 and a half to be precise. And Reagan, who at 69 looked great, spoke eloquently, and had people around him who were seasoned politicos, that one of those was Bill Casey, and he's a big part of this book. And Bill Casey, according to Craig Unger, orchestrated a plan to keep the hostages in Iran until the election was over. And they were released when Reagan took the oath of office on January 20th, 1981. But you were talking about the stolen debate book. Carter blamed George Will for that, I remember. And George Will, of course, vehemently denied it. But when you have access to what the other guy's saying, it might help you in the debate. And, of course, Reagan clobbered Carter in the one debate they had, Craig.
He absolutely did. You're right. And that was a big factor in the election, and the tide did sort of turn there. I was about to say that James Baker, who was then vice presidential candidate George Bush's close friend and later a cabinet official and a campaign manager and a powerful, powerful figure in Washington. But he testified during a congressional investigation that Casey stole the book and actually deposited it on his desk as they were preparing Reagan for the debate in October of 1980. But Casey was a spectacular figure. I think America's greatest spy in a lot of ways. And I sort of characterize him as sort of a cross between James Bond and Mr. Magoo. I mean, he had horrible table manners. He'd spill food everywhere. He mumbled all the time. He seemed to be going in 1,000 directions at once. And he was. But he had a secret network that was just unbelievable of arms dealers, political operatives, intelligence operatives in Israel and all throughout the Middle East. And he was working them for, I mean, just imagine trying to run a presidential campaign with one hand and the other do this secret covert operation. And Casey did it, and he pretty much got away with it.
And a listener notes correctly that what George Will, I think, did acknowledge was that he helped Reagan in his debate prep against Jimmy Carter. And as a journalist, that would certainly be taking sides. But I think George Will's a pundit, and we know that he is a conservative, so no surprise he was with Reagan. But Carter didn't do well in the debate, and Ronald Reagan apparently had some inside information, which benefited him, as you would imagine. Now, a listener asked, and a good point, and I alluded to it in the open, you were ostracized by your fellow press members. These are people at the highest levels of American journalism. What happened there?
Right. When I first started investigating this in 1991, and I did a big 9 or 10,000 word story for Esquire magazine, got a lot of attention, And then Newsweek hired me, and Congress started to investigate. So this was becoming a huge story during the run-up to the 1992 presidential election. George Bush Sr. was president at the time. He was involved in the conspiracy, though there are a lot of unanswered questions. So this was deemed an enormously explosive issue, and suddenly everything shifted into reverse. And I write about this at great length in the piece because, you know, this is really a spy story. It's a spy thriller, and suddenly the forces who wanted to cover everything up sprang into action. And I was sued by Bud McFarlane, who was Reagan's national security advisor. I won in the end, but it meant I was tied up in court for 4 or 5 years. People like me were derided as conspiracy nuts, essentially, the tinfoil hat wearing types. But over the years, I was able to, and I could see that a lot of the pushback was coming from Israeli intelligence, because they didn't want the story to come out. The Israelis helped Casey. They wanted Iran armed as well. They were concerned that a weak Iran would fall to Saddam Hussein in Iraq, and he was even a bigger threat to Israel than Iran was. So they didn't want it to come out that they had participated in a covert operation that sabotaged the United States, which of course is Israel's biggest patron. So all this disinformation was circulating, and it was used to try to discredit me and a few other people who were working on the October surprise. But I went back to it again and again. Over the years, I went to Israel to investigate and met with people in Israeli intelligence. I finally got to Iran in 2014. In 2016, I interviewed the former president of Iran, Abu Hassan Banisadr. And when I put it all together, I finally came up with a lot of new material that had never been revealed before. And they include, frankly, I have the receipts. I have documents showing that operatives who are working for the Republican campaign, for the Reagan campaign, who are working for Bill Casey, that they were selling arms to Iran, and the receipts are published in my book. These documents are. So I think it's pretty well conclusively documented at this point.
The book is Den of Spies from Craig Unger, one of the best in the business. Born in Dallas, raised there, educated at Harvard, and he's been on the American journalism scene for a generation. Thank you, Craig, and congratulations.
Thank you.
We're joined now by Fred Dent, financial analyst of renown who operates in Baton Rouge, and his first day as a financial star was 37 years ago this month, in October of 1987 on Black Monday when the stock market crashed. Fred Dent was on his first day on Wall Street, but he survived that, and now he still circulates in New York and in other places where the financial world is active, but he is based in Baton Rouge, and we had an interest rate cut, long anticipated, of a half point, and the markets have responded well, although last few days it's been moving back to the pack a bit. But your thoughts about whether this is something that will perhaps move the Dow and the S&P and all the measurements, the NASDAQ, forward?
Well, interest rates, when they're cut, that means money is cheaper, and it helps the economy by folks who want to buy a house and corporations who are borrowing, and it ultimately inures to earnings. And that's usually positive for stocks a year or two out. We don't know what's going to happen. We've got so much right now on the horizon, the immediate horizon. We've got they call it a skirmish, but it looks like more of a war to me going on in Israel with the Hezbollah, the Hamas, and the other Iranian proxy, the Houthis in Yemen. And so that could have a little short-term effect. But, you know, for the day-to-day wiggles, we just don't know. But long-term, the temporary declines are the lifeblood of the permanent advance.
Well, you were only 24 when you began your career on Wall Street, and for those of us who know Fred and knew his dad, you grew up in this town, and you were involved in politics at an early age, but
I was politically adjacent.
Politically adjacent.
I've never run
but,
for
but office. Fred was, I wouldn't call him a silver spoon guy. Back in the day, you were a waiter, weren't you?
Yeah, I was a waiter. I had the very good fortune for 4 years to work for Mr. Charles Brandt when I was in college, and people of a certain age will remember that restaurant, Charlie Brandt. And there's a story that relates to Wall Street that I like to tell, and that is one night I'm waiting on tables. The house is packed, and we used to say I'm in the weeds, and every table was full. It was VIPs in the house. And I loaded up a tray full of 6 salad plates on my shoulder, and I come out of the kitchen full speed, and as I come out, I hit a rolling cart, bam, that had been left there, and those salad plates go twirling through the air.
At Charlie Brandt.
At Charlie Brandt, right in the middle of the main dining room. They crash, the restaurant goes silent, and I say, oh, shoot. And now I've got to turn around and go back into the kitchen and face Mr. Brandt. And those of y'all who knew Mr. Brandt knew that he was a lovely, wonderful man, very warm. But he also had a temper, and I was afraid that he was going to blow up on me. I turn around, come back into the kitchen. He's standing there, and instead of blowing up on me, he said, clean it up.
All right.
He turned around and walked away.
Well, he did the right thing. And we'll be back and spend a few more minutes with Fred Dent after this. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. In just a bit, we'll hear from Mary Patricia Ray and Troy Hebert. Last night, there was a vice presidential debate. And, of course, it could affect the election, which is now 34 days away. Quite often, the politics of the White House are related to what's happening in the economy, and one of those big measurements now is how the market is doing. And there are more people invested now than ever before in stocks. And Fred, in the old days, this was something that probably a small percentage of Americans were involved with, but now I would say it's probably the majority of Americans have some connection that is tangible to Wall Street.
Yeah, it's. I think the number is about 50%, usually not direct investment, but passive investment through 401ks and retirement plans.
That counts.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, there was a gentleman, and I've been holding this story. He was front page New York Times in May, Jim Simons. He died in May. He was 86 years old, but he was a mathematician. And he abandoned an academic career, and he plunged into finance. He didn't know anything about it and became one of the most successful Wall Street investors ever. He lived the rest of his life in Manhattan. But after publishing studies in mathematics that would play a seminal role in quantum field theory, he then went to the stock market. And at age 40, he opened a small office in Long Island, a strip mall, set about proving that trading commodities, currencies, stocks, bonds could be nearly as predictable as calculus and partial differential equations. And his fund, Medallion, earned more than $100 billion in trading profits in the 30s.
I've never heard of the guy.
Jim Simon, well, there are a lot of people on Wall Street, but
those kind of luminaries.
And I don't think, unlike a few people we know about, I don't think he sought publicity.
Obviously not.
But I was thinking when I read this, you know, I wish I'd done this, but not everybody can do it. And of course, even those who have a great mind like this often are at risk of having hubris overtake good judgment, but he used his genius and he beat Wall Street. Is that an aberration, or could that be done by somebody else?
Well, it can be done by somebody else, but these anomalies are few and far between, and you typically don't hear about them. What I'm thinking about is going back well over 20 years, there was a hedge fund called Long-Term Capital Management. I don't know if you ever heard of them. They were huge, and it was founded by 4 Nobel Prize winners in economics. So these guys ostensibly knew the business and knew how to invest. And they got billions of dollars from various retirement funds, and they had a model that ostensibly would predict the market movements and currencies and stocks, et cetera. And it worked great until it didn't, and it blew up, and the U.S. government or rather, I believe the Federal Reserve had to bail them out. We, the taxpayers, bailed long-term capital management out. Now, there's actually a book called When Genius Failed, where you can learn more about that.
Yeah, I would imagine this guy is uncommon in many ways, but what a fascinating story for a guy who, as you note, didn't get a whole lot of attention, but he enjoyed a lavish lifestyle. The Times says he purchased a 220-foot yacht for $100 million, spent $50 million for a Fifth Avenue apartment in Manhattan, owned a 14-acre estate on Long Island Sound. He was a chain smoker and refused to put out his cigarettes in offices or at conferences and willingly paid fines instead. There's an iconoclast, right?
We know people like that.
Yeah, we do. We do. But he did die at 86. And who knows? He might have made it to 96 or 106 if he hadn't been smoking those deadly cigarettes. But he had quite a life. And Fred Dent, you have stayed the course. And in your line of work, I would imagine you could keep, we talked about this a few months ago, you could keep going for a long time.
I'm shooting for 80, age 80.
Yeah, and as we segue to, and you're 61 now, I know, a little bit younger than I am, and you're 2 years older than Tim Walz, and you look 25 years younger than he does. Well, that guy, he looked beat up and battered and... The optics. We'll talk with Mary Patricia Ray and Troy Hebert, but J.D. Vance, who is 19 years younger, looks 39 years younger than Tim Walz. So maybe he should have gone in the stock business and been a financial analyst rather than a coach and a governor.
Well, there's less sun exposure in the financial field, so he's out on the field all the time and probably didn't wear sunscreen.
And he can't pronounce nuclear either.
Oh.
Never trust a person who can't pronounce nuclear. It's nuclear. Jimmy Carter, who was a nuclear engineer, said nuclear. And, of course, George W. Bush did the same thing. It's nuclear.
Well.
And that's a pretty easy word, too. That's not a tongue twister.
Yeah. Well, if you're hooked on phonics, you know that kind of stuff.
Well, thank you, Fred Dent.
Thanks, Joe.
Well, Mary Patricia Ray, I remember 4 years ago on this show after the vice presidential debate, you said, Kamala Harris looked radiant, and she did look good. Mike Pence looked good, although he had a fly in his hair for most of the debate. but Walz, when it comes to optics, and optics mean a lot in television, and this was a televised debate, I think it was almost like Nixon and Kennedy. He didn't look as vibrant as J.D. Vance did. Your fellow Ohio State alum.
I'm going to say, respectfully, as someone who's helped a lot of average-looking men prepare to appear on television, that I actually don't think either of them are above-average-looking people. One of them is wearing permanent makeup, and one isn't.
And who would that be? J.D.?
Yeah. I mean, that eyeliner, it's really out of control.
A Marine wearing eyeliner?
Look, that's fine. I mean, I'm not making any sort of personal character judgments about it. No, I actually thought what they did with Coach was probably a good thing in terms of who they are trying to appeal to. A little bit shorter haircut, actually great stage makeup, and a suit that didn't look too custom. He looked like a normal average person.
The Coach?
Yeah.
You said short haircut. He doesn't have much hair, does he?
They definitely cut it even shorter. And I think they're not trying to appeal to you, Tim, or Jim. They're trying to appeal to white women that want to feel confident that they can sort of be safe.
Well, you
with
represented
one of these guys.
John Bell Edwards, a brilliant man, but follically challenged.
You know, not as follically challenged in 2015 as he probably was after 8 years as governor, which is to be expected. And, you know, look, I wouldn't last a day as a fourth grade teacher. Governor Walz did for quite some time. I imagine that also ages
one. But he doesn't know how to say nuclear.
Well, you know, he doesn't believe that women should have to beg for their lives when they're having a miscarriage. And I think that the goal of both candidates, and why we've seen most of the polls say that it was a tie, was frankly to pump up the base that they have and maybe grow the base slightly. Mm-hmm. I think both of them did that work. And I think, you know, we saw them talk about, I think, about 8 or 9 issues. And I actually took a lot of notes about this.
Well,
debate.
I want to get Troy Hebert in on this. And, of course, he is bullish on Donald Trump. And Trump has chosen J.D. Vance as his running mate. And he helped him get elected to the Senate seat in Ohio. I don't think J.D. Vance would have won without Trump's support. But J.D. Vance, who is, Mary Patricia says, is a some would say a far-right conservative, he's now all but pro-choice on abortion, saying the state should decide and that he was never for a universal ban. Of course, he was, but now he says he was not. And if most states decide, most of the states with the big populations would vote to keep abortion. And he's also in all but in favor of the Affordable Care Act. So Troy Hebert, J.D. Vance, is sounding like he's sounding like an Obama Democrat. Your thoughts?
Well, first, good morning to y'all and all your listeners. First of all, I just want to start and say I'm very proud of both of those gentlemen for having a gentleman debate last night. I thought they both handled themselves very well. Of course, the only differences are is the policies. And, you know, I've said this before, Jim, on your show, is that, you know, Republicans, in my opinion, have good policy and Democrats have good politics. And so last night, I think the style of both of them was very good. I think they were very cordial with each other. I really liked the way they greeted each other at the beginning and at the end. We need more of that in politics. Unfortunately, we have less and less of it. As far as for Vance, I just think he's a polished Donald Trump. You know, I really do. I think he was very disciplined, unlike Trump. And I think he got his message across. And I think he did to Trump ticket a lot of good last night.
Mary Patricia.
Well, you know, J.D. Vance is Donald Trump's intellectual Zamboni. I mean, he just comes behind him and sort of cleans up the mess. Which means that he often has to contradict himself, which is why I think he was very concerned about whether he was going to be fact-checked. We heard him say, you aren't supposed to be fact-checking me. But look, these debates don't really matter anymore, Jim, except for that they help raise money and help bump the polls a little bit to increase enthusiasm about the race, unless you make a big mistake. And both candidates decided not to be sassy. It made me a little bit sad. I kind of wanted to hear some mean. But, you know, I do have to salute mm-hmm. both of them for trying to stick to the issues, even though in many ways, I think I counted that J.D. Vance said China 37 times during the debate. So you can sort of pretend that there was a lot of issue-based discussion going on, or you can realize that there was a lot of dog whistling happening, just like in every other debate. This looked more like a pre-Trump debate to me than anything we've seen since maybe a Romney-Obama debate.
It apparently will be the last debate of the season, though. Donald Trump says he will not debate again. And Troy, you said he shouldn't have debated the first time, and you said it before the showdown with Kamala Harris. Is he making a good choice by staying away from round two?
Well, Jim, and if you also remember, I said he shouldn't have debated the second time either. Trump don't belong in the debate stage. Trump is a show horse, and he shines when he's by himself on the mic, and he can do and say in the rules of his rules. When he gets in a situation where he has to be disciplined, that's just not where he shines. He shines a lot of other places, but not there. So both debates he shouldn't have attended. If he wouldn't have went to the first one, this race would be over with, because if you remember, I also mentioned that I didn't think Biden was going to stay in, and then Trump probably knocked out the only person he could really beat. And it's a shame.
Okay, we'll spend some more time with Troy Hebert and Mary Patricia Ray after this. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to Talk Louisiana. The first and only vice presidential debate of the campaign was last night, and there wasn't a clear winner, as there was with Donald Trump slamming Joe Biden in June and Kamala Harris whipping Donald Trump in September. Last night is, according to many, a dead heat, and it also was vice president, not president, and there's some conjecture that really doesn't matter who wins, because Lloyd Benson certainly beat Dan Quayle in 1988, and then Quayle and George Bush went out and won 40 states. Your thoughts? 877-217-5757. Former state lawmaker Troy Hebert on the right, he's supporting Donald Trump, and Mary Patricia Ray, who's a Democrat, top drawer strategies, who actually will be on the road in the next few weeks, and she's headed to Pennsylvania. Surprise, surprise. Let's go to Dan downtown. Dan, you're on the air with Troy and Mary Patricia. Hello, Dan.
Hey, hello. Yeah, your first guest this morning's talk about Bob Casey's treason would seem to refute Troy Hebert's claim of the Democrats having better politics than Republicans.
All right. Is it Bob Casey or Bill Casey? There is a Bob Casey, as we know, but the CIA director was, I think, Bill Casey. But anyway, October surprises. This is October, and could there be a surprise that would swing the election? Because right now, it's 49.4, Harris 49.3, Trump is probability of winning in Las Vegas. So it's a dead heat. Dead heat. And what can happen, Mary Patricia? And were there any memorable lines from last night that will resonate far after this debate?
Oh, I mean, I think both candidates got a couple of good ones in. And I think Senator Vance did his, you know, that's your running mate, not mine line, though it's hard to connect that to a specific issue. What I did is I broke down each issue that was discussed and kind of like who expanded their base as a determination of whether they won that issue or not. And I had, a tie really on Middle East, probably Vance, climate change to walls, immigration to walls, fiscal slightly to walls, reproductive rights. I think just based on national public opinion, walls, guns, more credible walls, actually talked about owning one, housing. There was no plan from Vance, so that went to walls. Insurance and healthcare, the only person who actually talked about something more than a concept of a plan, walls. You know, so but does that matter to the American public? I don't know. Senator or Governor Walz, I think, best line was, he asked the American people, will you keep your oath of office if the president doesn't with regard to election stealing? And I think that being at the end of the debate was an important line for him to get in and really increase his credibility in terms of being a student of democracy, which is what he was as a teacher.
Troy Hebert, I imagine you have a little bit of a different perspective.
Well, I got to give it to my friend Mary Patricia. She is a cheerleader for her Democratic candidates. But let me just say this. I think the most important question that anybody can ask in any debate or on the street or at a coffee shop is, how are you feeling today? What do you think about this country today? What do you think where we are today versus when Donald Trump was the president? And I can tell you all of those issues that Mary Patricia talked about, when you ask them about what you think about immigration and an open border, what do you think about the fact that we have two wars going on that could turn into, I don't know, World War III? What about the fact of inflation? What about the cost of milk, bread? What about jobs? Those are just the bread and milk issues that I think people are talking about. And I think at the end of the day, they're going to ask themselves, once again, are we better off today or we were 4 years ago? That's an easy answer, and that's why Donald Trump's going to pull this thing off.
And with respect to Senator Hebert, you know, I think it probably is an easy answer for a lot of people, but I'm not sure that he's considered how easy of an answer it is for American women. Because we really can't be concerned about the price of a gallon of milk if we're not sure whether we'll live just because we got pregnant. And that is definitely on our minds, I promise you, no matter where we live and no matter what our party is.
And more women vote than men. And there is a huge, huge gender gap. We're talking more than double digits. Trump leading men, and
it's a privilege in this country to be worried about the economy.
There you go.
When you are worried about living
well,
and dying.
Well, you've lined them up, and let's go to the phones, but please be brief. David in Atlanta, you're on. What's your question, David?
Good morning. Mr. Hebert, you mentioned the high price of food and eggs and so forth. Trump added $7.8 trillion to the national debt. The government has to constantly refinance that, which means they compete in the private sector for money, so interest rates are higher. So when you complain about high prices, businesses pass that interest rate on to the consumer.
All right. Is that a valid point? Trump did add more to the debt than any president. Now, Biden has also added to the debt, but not quite at the rate as his predecessor.
Well, look, let's face it. Both parties add to the debt. They both drunk spenders, okay?
But well, I can Bill, tell Clinton, you this. Bill Clinton, Bill Clinton, he balanced the budget.
Well, let's talk recent. Jim, that's a long time ago. Some of the people you listen to wasn't even born then.
Well, he left office in 2001. That's only 23 years.
Okay, but you got a lot of,
okay,
you got a lot of people,
okay,
that don't
okay,
remember that.
Yeah, you make
the
a point.
The point is this. The point is this. It's real simple. Interest rates were 3% and 4% under Trump, and now they 7% and 8%. So go ask the young people who are trying to buy a home. Go ask the people that are carrying all of this debt with interest that they can't even afford to buy things today. I mean, it's just simple. I mean, if you look at the numbers, I know you can spend it, and I appreciate your caller's point, but at the end of the day, it's double. It's double.
All right.
Today.
Mary Patricia?
You know, inflation means different things to different people. If you're a rich person, it means something about interest rates. And if you're not, it means something about whether you're going to choose between the light bill and buying groceries. And I think the fundamental difference between the presentations that we saw last night in the debate is one person has an understanding of that, and one person wrote a book faking an understanding of that. And it shines through to me that's nothing to do with being a cheerleader for anyone. I just simply listened to what was said about stable housing, and another guy saying, like, we'll stabilize housing by building it on federal lands. There was no substance.
All right. Randy and Zachary. Randy, please be brief. Randy, you're on. Good morning,
sir. Good morning. As of 4 years ago, yes, I do feel much better being a person of color, not having Donald Trump in the White House. But let me ask you this. Mr. Vance, he follows Chris Yarvin, who espouses delete the U.S. government, firing all of the employees, retiring the university employees, and selling their assets. Do you really believe that that was a real portrayal of both men?
All right. Did they both play to the crowd, and Vance perhaps stretching his epiphany a bit more than Coach Walls? Mary Patricia?
Well, you know, Vance was trying to play a normal version of himself. He's not a normal person. He doesn't have a normal educational background, and he doesn't even have a normal life for someone who does have a degree from an Ivy League school. And I think Tim Walls was just playing himself. So ultimately, you know, I think that pleases the base of each group and doesn't grow the base much more.
All right. Troy?
Well, first of all, again, if I ever run another campaign, Mary Patricia is going to be my campaign manager because she stays focused on the issues. So having said that, look, at the end of the day, when you say Vance is not a normal person or whatever, hell, I don't know if any of us are normal today. But at the end of the day, Vance has a great story. He wrote a book about it. That ought to be celebrated by the Democrats.
All right.
Well, that guy, how he was raised, where he was raised.
My family's from Appalachia, and we were raised much better than J.D. Vance, I promise you.
Doug on Highland. Doug, good morning. You're on.
Good morning. Mr. Vance came across as very reasonable and smooth, but he also lied continually. And one of the lies he told was that President Trump, I'm forgetting the exact words, somehow helped the Affordable Care Act. And actually, anyone without amnesia remembers that President Trump hated the Affordable Care Act, like he hated anything that had anything to do with Obama.
That is correct. And I'll tell you what, we're going to take a few more calls if we can, and then get Mary and Patricia and Troy to wrap it up. Patrick and Inniswald, please, you're on quickly. Hi, Patrick.
Hey, I thought Trump won the last debate, and then this debate was kind of, I didn't think Vance really won it, but the media says the exact opposite of what I think. Who determines who wins the debate?
I think that'll be determined in large part on November 5th, but I don't see how you could say Trump won the last debate. But Patrick does. James in Metairie. Hello, James.
Good morning, everybody. Mr. Abier, the real suckers and losers in this country are the ones who are sitting in prison right now for believing Donald Trump, claiming the election was stolen. Last night, J.D. Vance was asked that question, and he refused to answer it. Do you think the election was stolen?
All right. What about the election of 2020? Stolen or not?
I think it was stolen, but in a different way, not on the vote count. I think whatever the vote count is pretty much what it is. I think it was stolen by the media and all of the false pretenses about the 52 people that signed a letter about the Russian collusion and all other stuff. So I think the propaganda is what made the election not fair. As far as for the vote count, I think the vote count was the vote count.
Mary?
The vote count was the vote count. The popular vote count indicates a winner, and so does the Electoral College, which is the final determination. And the guy who's president right now got more Electoral College votes than the guy who is a convicted felon and can't own a gun in several states in America, though he says he's pro-gun.
Well, and for those who are either heartened or disheartened, depending on your candidate, at this point, exactly October 2nd, 4 years ago, Joe Biden, in a compilation of national polls, led by 7.4%. Harris leads by 2% right now, which shows you why Harris's lead is uneasy and uncertain, because even though Biden did end up winning the overall vote by more than 3%, It was not 7.4, and it was relatively close in three states that could have swung the election to Donald Trump. So we'll see, and we'll be calling on Mary Patricia and Troy again very soon.
Thanks for having us, Jim.
Thank you. And we'll be back tomorrow.
Thanks, Jim.
Thanks, Troy.
Stay safe. Stay tuned.